From the Ante Up headquarters in Tampa Bay, Florida, it's the Ante Up PokerCast. And now, here are two guys who think they know how to play poker, Chris Cosenza and Scott Long.
It's January 29th, 2021, and you're listening to the best PokerCast on the planet. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
Today is the day that I'm grateful that our show is not a vodcast, because, I mean, at like 4 a.m., I woke up from a nightmare that involved you, and I never went back to sleep, and then I kind of fell back to sleep around 7:30, but then I didn't get enough sleep, so now my eyes are all black, and of course, it was poker-related, like I said earlier last month, or this month, maybe, where I said, you know, the two nightmares I have are going back to work and poker. This is another one. I found out that you were hiding a large debt from me that you let someone skate. Like, we were running a poker room on the ship or something, and one of the guys kept asking for credit, and then I found out he was a friend of yours, and he was in debt to us for $71,000.
$71,000.
And I'm like, I know this doesn't happen very often, but I'm going to yell at you, Scott. I start screaming at you in the dream, and you're like, you had your head down. You're like, you knew there's nothing you could do. You couldn't say anything. You knew you were wrong. And it was so sweet. It was actually not a nightmare at the end. It was pretty good.
I thought the guy was the nicest guy ever. He gave me Oreos, and, you know, so don't worry. I'm going to get out of it.
Yeah, well, just don't come to me in a Turkish bath and tell me your stories, all right, because I don't care.
I got a line on a municipal game upstate, so...
Oh, man. Well, I'm just happy it's a podcast today, not a vodcast.
I think not only are we happy that it's a podcast, I think everybody listening is happy that it's a podcast.
Small victories, my friend. Small victories.
I do chuckle anytime somebody messages, have you guys ever thought about making a video? And I'm like, no. Yeah. No, I have not. No. Have you seen me? Here's a picture of
my brother says it all the time to me. He's like, I'm telling you guys, the way you guys get along and everything, you should do your own vodcast, and you should probably have your own reality show. And I'm like, yeah, no. No.
I'm not going to disparage you, but I will disparage myself. I have a face made for radio.
So. It's not even that good. It's podcast. They have to choose when they want to listen to you.
We're like the basic cable radio.
Oh, man.
All right. So, Midway Poker Tour founder Dan Bekovec, who hasn't been seen in public since leaving the inaugural event of his Chicago area poker tour without enough money to pay winners, fired a couple bullets, Chris, in the recently concluded Mid-States Poker Tour $1,100 buy-in main event in Iowa. At least one of the players who was owed money told Poker News this week that he does not expect to ever collect his winnings.
This is just one of those items where you're just like, yes, we're all enraged. Move on. I don't know what to say about this. I mean...
All right, so here's an interesting thing I thought yesterday, right? So, and please... Please, everyone, understand, I am not defending this dirtbag whatsoever, right?
Right.
But it's kind of like, you know, when the Full Tilt guy started showing up, right? And your initial reaction is outrage. Like, how could you be out there playing with my money? That's so wrong. When you owe me all this money, you're a dirtbag. And then part of you in the back is like, if he wins, do I think I actually get my money back? Maybe I should root for that. I don't know.
I don't know. This isn't Phil Ivey in a court case already ruled against them, right? This is just... and this is also a sped-up scenario, too. This guy is right back in playing mode not that long after it happened. At least the Full Tilt guys went underground for, like, at least a couple of years, and the other ultimate bet-stealing guy, Hamilton, right? Russ Hamilton.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. It's been so long I even forgot his name, too.
I know.
I mean, if you're looking for a bright spot, and I always try to find the bright spot, folks, that's the best I can do. I'm sorry. Otherwise, I mean, really, the brass balls here, right?
Yeah. Yeah. You're not a true journalist. True journalists don't look for the bright side.
Yeah, that's right. But, you know, we're journalists and we're poker advocates. So I like to advocate on behalf of our 14 listeners and make sure that I can try to give them something to make them feel better about this.
That's true.
That was the best I could do, but man, I just, you know, I mean, it's just like, so, you know, one of the funny things that I don't know if it was in the Poker News article or one of the other articles I read about this, but they call this the Fire Festival of Poker.
Uh-huh.
So have you watched these Fire Festival documentaries?
No, I have not.
Oh my God. Absolutely. Everybody listening, you need to put the Fyre Festival documentaries on your watch list. The Netflix one, I think, was the one I watched. There's also one on Hulu. I've been told the Netflix one is way better. Your jaw will be dropped the entire time. So the Fyre Festival was this big, huge music festival a couple years ago where this guy just super Ponzi schemed the entire thing, and it collapsed in spectacular fashion. And it was just amazing to watch the lengths that he went to try to make this work, and how successful he was to get people's money, and how unsuccessful he was in delivering a product at all, right? And so when I saw that, whoever wrote that, I'm like, all right, that's exactly it. This guy promoted the world, and hey, this is going to be the most fantastic poker tour ever, and you're going to get paid out in silver, and then decided to not even show up for the last day. Which, that was a new part that I didn't see, that the tournament director had resigned the day before over this. And then this guy, so the charity was actually running the tournament on the final day. So, I mean, not only were they, like, stuck not being able to pay out, but can you imagine your your local Rotary Club trying to make floor calls?
Yeah.
I just, you know, wow. So, yeah, so why don't you guys watch the Fyre, and it's F-Y-R-E, by the way. So,
if you're looking for that. Yeah, when you type it in the name, it's F-Y-R. So the last time you did this to me, it was, what, Tiger King or something, and you made me watch it, and I'm loving that, so I'm probably going to get hooked on this now.
Well, I mean, my wife and I were so amazed at the one, because we actually didn't really hear about the Fyre Festival before. I mean, obviously a lot of people knew about it before, so... So it was all new to us. And then I'm like, wow, do we want to watch the Hulu one? She's like, no, I've seen enough of this.
All right, yeah. Good.
The poker's version of the Fyre Festival.
Nice.
All right, a 23-year-old Dutch designer has debuted a set of gender-neutral playing cards, Chris, that replace the kings, queens, and jacks with gold, silver, and bronze cards. She has sold more than 1,500 decks of the GSB cards. They're very clever. Gold, silver, bronze.
Yes.
Get it?
Yes.
Get it.
Yes.
Reaction on the internet has, as expected, been divided, with some saying that it's time for the gender hierarchy of cards to be gone, and others bemoaning the move and reminding players that the highest-ranking card is a gender-neutral ace.
Okay, so I am perhaps the most woke person, at least on this podcast, but I know...
You clearly are the most woke person.
But on this planet, probably. But enough's enough. I mean, seriously, I mean... I don't care what the cards have on them. If you want to put bears and monkeys and tigers, oh my, I don't care. That's whatever you want to do with your cards that you're making is fine. But to have people calling out that it's time to get rid of it, that's just ridiculous. I mean, it's just ridiculous. I mean, I'm totally in support of people designing their cards the way they want to, and you know, I mean, remember the outrage when our good friends at J Design made the nine like three across, like the Brady Bunch, right? Three across, three across, three across, and people just freaked out, and then he had to make a different version. You know, I mean, you can do whatever you want with your cards, but I mean, to like have like a bunch of people complaining that the hierarchy needs to be gone, it's just ridiculous.
Yeah, absolutely. You know? Well, there's a couple of things I would like to say about this. And I usually get in trouble saying this, so I will admit that, and I will get in trouble again. I'm one of these guys that believes that art belongs in its era. So I'm not a big fan of these people going back and editing old movies to take out the offensive stuff, you know, cutting out that now offensive episode of Friends out of the catalog so you can't see it again. Because that was like, it's history, right? It's part of the time and the era, and that doesn't mean that it's not offensive now, but it means that we're educated enough to be able to look at that and be reminded of a time that was different, right? So that's kind of where I fall on this. You know, I'm not saying that king is always better than a queen and all that kind of stuff, but I'm like, historically, I mean, playing cards were from royalty, and that's how it was in the past. Now, let's be clear, too. There are a lot of times that queens rule the world, too, right? So
yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's not like kings have always ruled. So there's that history lesson, too. So there's that part. The other part is I have trouble with the criticism of it as well, too. I like, as you mentioned, anybody can make their cards however they want. You buy them, you don't buy them. Who cares? Now, if this was like, you know, some worldwide rule now that this is the only card you can make, all right, different story. Or if, say, the World Poker Tour or World Series of Poker decided, hey, we're only going to play with gender-neutral cards. Yeah, all right, so maybe a little bit of debate there. But right now, I mean, you know, Godspeed to this woman. Sell as many cards as you want. People are going to buy them if they want them. If they don't, why are you wasting time on? This is another reason I hate Twitter. Have I ever mentioned how much I hate Twitter? Because that was all the criticism was tweets from Piers Morgan and all kinds of other people. So
from now on, when you say you have a straight, you'd say Ace GSB10?
Yeah.
You know, yeah, can't say straight to the G.
Yeah. You gotta get woke, Chris.
I'm getting woker by the minute.
So anyhow, I hope all of the riches for this this Dutch design. You know, you do you, and the rest of the world will do themselves.
Yeah, I agree.
We'll all be, drink a Coke and sing and happy come together. Okay, I'm ready for this one, Chris. I think we're going to have a little fun with this. So, you know, we've debated what the best poker movie is on the show several times, probably ad nauseum, right?
Yes.
And you've always been on Team Rounders. I've always been on Team Cincinnati Kid, right?
Yes.
I don't want to spoil the conversation, but I might be converted today. I will decide when we get to this point. But so here's the thing. Screen Rant now has listed the top 10 poker movies, I'm sorry, as ranked by Internet Movie Database, known better by its initials, IMDb. On IMDb, users are allowed to rank a movie on a scale of 1 to 10 once and only once. And then IMDb adjusts those rankings ever so slightly so certain demographics don't dominate a movie's ranking. And a couple other things I want to mention here. I don't believe they actually have a poker movie category on IMDb. So
right.
I'm going to assume that Screen Rant has decided what is a poker movie and what isn't. So there might be other movies out there that that should have been included here. I think clearly some of these movies have poker elements, but you and I and the rest of our 14 listeners would not say it's a poker movie, right?
Yeah.
So the ranking is not how good of a poker movie this is. The ranking is how good of a movie this is, right? So keep that in mind, right?
I think that the world needs to wake up and realize that there aren't even 10 good poker movies. We have to stop doing this list of 10 because you can see they're clearly struggling to find enough to fill 10, because the ones on this list aren't even, they're just not even worth considering. So I'm just confused why people keep coming up with these lists. Just do a top five. Even then you're going to struggle. And they're real stretches too with some of them. Some of them are poker, but I don't know. I don't agree with the list, so I can't wait.
I can't imagine anybody agrees with the list, but the reason they do it, Chris, is for click.
I think the reason why they had 10 here was to make Matt Savage happy.
Yeah. Well, speaking of that, number 10 was Lucky You.
There you go.
And again, no disrespect to the fantastic cast of Lucky You, but the highlight of that movie for me is that Matt Savage still gets a royalty check every time it airs. So, so it's in one sense at the bottom of this list. And actually, I'm not even going to put it at the bottom of this list. I think there's some movies on here that are worse than that.
Oh, I agree.
But clearly, it is not one of the poker top movies, right?
Right.
All right. So number 9 is High Roller, the Stu Unger story. We talked about this not too long ago, the Michael Imperioli from Sopranos playing. And it was a god-awful flick.
It really was. Really was. But it was poker, though. It was poker.
Yeah, we could say that with Lucky You and High Roller. They yep. are absolutely, without a doubt, poker movies.
Yep.
Just not very good movies. all right, number 8 was Mississippi Grind. And I have a confession here. I don't think I ever got around to watching this.
Oh, man. Now
I
we're screwed.
When it came out, it wasn't like in the theaters, right, or a limited release. And then it went to some streaming service I didn't have. And I might need to follow up and watch this now because, you know, mad props to Ryan Reynolds. So
yeah, now we're screwed because I didn't see it either. So now I can't say if it actually belongs on this list or not, if it was poker or not. I don't know.
Again, it is a poker movie. So so they started strong at the bottom of the list on poker movies. Two of them not so good. One N.A. for both of us. So.
Oh, man.
Have to check that out. TBD, I guess, right?
So. We'll get back to you. That's how we're going to extend the show. We're going to keep bringing up stuff that we can't really talk intelligently about and then get back to you in a sequel.
All right, now number seven, a good movie, lots of poker in it, not a poker movie, I don't think, Maverick.
You're right. I mean, it's more about on the run kind of hijinks and stuff with a big poker scene and a couple of poker smaller scenes, but yeah, I don't think it's a poker movie either.
And this is kind of what I was getting at with that extra information I provided. I'm like, I can see you take an average moviegoer, right? Uh-huh. And you put them in front of Maverick, Mel Gibson, Jodie Foster, you know, fun flick, the old Wild West, right?
Yeah.
Riverboat stuff. And then put them in front of High Roller, the Stu Unger story. Clearly, not even saying the quality of the movie, but just the specificity of the movie, more people are going to like Maverick than Stu Unger story, right?
Yeah.
So that's kind of the fallacy we're going with here. So, but Maverick was enjoyable. It's not one of those that I have to stop when I flip in the channels and it's on. But it was a good flip. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, I wasn't disappointed.
Yeah. All right, number six. I think this is a completely, completely underrated movie. And Mike Fassin and I used to talk about this on the show all the time. And California Split.
Boo.
And I know you're not a big fan of it, which is too bad because it is a great, great, not great, great movie. It's a fun, fun movie to watch.
Yeah, the first 10 minutes is poker. After that, it's like, okay, where are you going? Where are you going to be? And then for the most part, it's sort of like on the same sort of track as like a Maverick where they're just getting into these trouble and they're running around California and Reno and all, whatever. And it's like, poker movie, I guess. But the opening of the poker movie was like a lot of poker. And then it faded.
Yeah, and then it ended with poker, though. So, yeah. I mean, I would put it in the poker movie category, even though, as you were correct, the middle of it was more of a buddy flick than a poker flick. But if you haven't heard of California Split, it's from the 70s. And Elliot Gould and I forget the other key actor in it. But what I really liked about it, it was back in the self-deal days in the California
Club. Yeah, that's the thing.
Which you and I never experienced, right? And I can't even imagine. So it's really a time capsule poker movie where that was actually how poker was, unlike some of these other older movies that we're going to talk about soon that are kind of fictional. But that was actually how it was back then. So that was really cool to see. And then, of course, the whole you can't throw oranges on the escalator scene. I mean, that's cinematic gold.
I thought you liked – I guess you don't like the show The Goldbergs. Right.
It's not that I don't like it. I have not seen an episode, and I've been told by multiple people, including you, that I should see it because obviously I'm an 80s fan.
Yeah, I mean, it's right. Well, the reason why I brought it up is because George Segal's on that in that show, and he's the other guy in the movie. And
that's right. Yeah.
I was like, how could you not remember George Segal? But I love that show. I mean, that show, just because that's exactly when we grew up. And so everything they talk about on the show is, you know, in the 80s, and then they bring up all the stuff we did in our childhood, from games to movies to, you know, it's hilarious. And then, of course, the show is really monotonous because it's pretty much the same, storyline every week, but they use a different mode of, you know, a vehicle to get you through the same crap. But it's so kitschy. It's really good. But anyway, George Segal was on that. He was in that movie too. So it was a big cast. I mean, it was a good movie. I didn't really, it's not that I didn't like the movie either. I enjoyed the movie from the buddy movie standpoint. Yeah. I just was thinking, oh, you guys talked about it on the show so much. I'm like, all right, I'm going to watch this. And then the next week I couldn't wait to be on the show to just knock it. Cause it was like, are you kidding me? But the beginning and the end for poker. Yeah, it was good.
And it is a very 70s movie, too. Not only filmed in the 70s, but you look at it, I'm like, yep, that's 70s.
Right? Yeah.
So, which I think is kind of the discussion we're going to have with a couple of these other movies, too, that they are from a different era of movie making. So, you know, some people like that, some people don't. So that affects your opinion of it, too, right?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Like, for example, number five, A Big Hand for the Little Lady. Fasso, of course, I mentioned this quite a bit on the show, and I will admit that I never got around to seeing it, so that's another TBA.
No, I saw it.
No, okay, great.
Well, oh, yeah, I saw it.
TBA for our listeners, then.
It's interesting that it's you know, considered a poker movie because they put it in the title, and, of course, there is this one hand that, you know, she has to try to secure enough funds to be able to call the bet and all this crap or whatever it is, and It's interesting. I mean, it's poker in that the whole, like, the whole problem for the people in the movie is centered around this poker hand, but the movie's not poker. You know what I mean? It's like, okay, they get into a game, they have a game, and all of a sudden this big hand happens, and they're like, the lady's husband dies or whatever it is, and they're like, okay, well, you need to, you know, how are you going to... She's like, oh, I'm going to go secure the funds somehow and make some calls. And then the rest of the movie is them just trying to figure out how she can make enough money to call this one hand or whatever it is. And it's like, eh, it's not really a poker movie. It's just the vehicle to tell a story, you know, rather than actually being a poker movie. But
so in that sense, it's not the only movie on this list that has one poker scene.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
All right, well, maybe I'll get around to watching that while you're watching the Fyre Festival. compare notes afterwards.
Yeah.
All right, number four, this is where blasphemy sets in. Rounders.
Oh, God. Just put a knife right through my heart right now.
All right, again, as I mentioned at the top of the show, I've always been more of a Cincinnati kid, but there's no way that Rounders is not at least the second best poker movie of all time. And I will go ahead and say that I am thinking that it is holding up the test of time better than Cincinnati Kid. I mean, Rounders was in the 90s, 97, right? So it's about 23 years old, something like that.
Yeah, it's old.
And I every time I watch it, I don't watch as much as you do, but it is a movie that I stop when it's on, right?
Yeah.
I think it holds up. I think it holds up. And Cincinnati Kid, I'm not saying it doesn't hold up. I mean, that it had a good 30 years on Rounders, right? So we'll have to wait 30 years. From now on, we're celebrating the 45th year of the PokerCast.
Oh, jeez.
To reassess Rounders and whether it had the same staying power. But I do think it holds up better than Cincinnati Kid.
Absolutely. It is blasphemy on number four. I mean, if it's not one, or it's got to be two. If it's not two, it's got to be one. There's no way. There's two, three movies ahead of it. No way. Sorry. Yeah. That's what I'm talking about. Like, that's when you say that there's a top 10 list, they can't even come up with five movies. And when they do, they put Rounders four. And I mean, it doesn't even make sense, you know? It doesn't even make sense. All right, go ahead.
So I guess the other part that surprises me about this, I mean, obviously we're poker players, so we really geek out about the poker and how realistic the poker is in this movie, right? But it seems like a movie that people that aren't into poker would find enjoyable.
Yeah.
You know, I can watch a movie about, let's see, bowling or bonsai tree cutting or whatever like that and not really be into those things, but if the movie's well done, be like, hey, I really enjoyed this, right?
Absolutely, yeah. Especially when there's other themes woven so carefully throughout the movie, like struggles with paying bills for school and love interests and illegal, you know, things going on and struggling with the path of your life because, you know, your professor is a judge who was supposed to be a rabbi. And I mean, there's all these other things inside this movie besides just, I raise, you know, and all that. I mean, that's why it's such a good movie, you know, and that's why, and another thing too is, plus it's to us, those actors are still relevant that are in most of the stars of this show or the movie are still relevant. The terms, the game is still relevant. Yeah. Whereas Cincinnati Kid, no one plays, you know, five card stud. I mean, it just doesn't happen. And most of these other movies too would have games that, you know, don't really, or things that don't really still happen today. Whereas Rounders, everything that happened in Rounders essentially still happens today, other than at the end when he talks about, you know, it's the same five guys, the final table, the main, you know, that obviously it's grown more than that, but other than that, it's still Hold'em, it's still the same way, the same lingo, the same backroom games and that kind of thing. And I just, that's why number four is just, this is why if you're going to have a list about a theme, you got to have an expert in the theme help you with the ranking, not right, just some numerical scale.
That's why I clarified that it wasn't really poker movies. It was citing what they thought was a poker movie, right? So,
yeah.
And you made a good point. How is it possible that a movie starring Matt Damon, Norton, and, of course, Gretchen Mol?
Yeah, Fetch and Gretchen.
Not a 10 out of 10, right? Well, no matter what it's about, right?
Yeah.
It could be about tiddlywinks. So.
And it'd be bonsai trees, and you'd watch.
All right, number three is the Cincinnati Kid. So if you're waiting at home for the first two, yeah, you're going to be pretty
shocked. Oh, Cincinnati Kid.
Now, again, I've always loved the Cincinnati Kid. Again, it's been a while since I've seen it, so now I kind of feel like I want to go back and watch it again. I just really like the story. Steve McQueen was just such a great actor and such a great person back then in movies that he really carried that movie really well, I think. And yeah, it just had a different feel than Rounders, right? Mm-hmm. So, and from a different era, '60s. But certainly you can't say there wasn't a lot of poker in there.
Not only that, but do you ever like... I don't know if it's like music or TV shows or whatever, but you ever, when you were younger, you hated that TV show or you hated that song, but now as you're older, you like, you hear that song on the radio or on wherever you hear it, and you all of a sudden you're like, oh yeah, and you know all the lyrics to it. You're yep. like, how do I, and you end up liking it over time because you start to appreciate it, especially with what's out today. That's the same thing for me with Cincinnati Kid. When I watched it in the moment, I was like, oh, you gotta be kidding me. Now, I appreciate that movie way more, especially since they have stuff like, you know, Big Hand for a Little Lady on this list,
yeah, right.
You know, but I did. I appreciate the movie. And of course, Robinson and the rest of the cast, it was really a good movie that way. And I don't know, I ended up liking it a lot more now than I did when I first watched it. So,
yeah.
But it was
and
good.
Again, it was five card too, which is a game you didn't see very often as well too. Right.
Yeah.
So, unfortunately, in play, it's not as exciting as they made it in the movie, but it's different. It's interesting. So, you know, you don't have all the... Here's the thing that I talk about with folks with when you watch these 60s movies. They didn't have the special effects you have now, right?
Yeah.
You didn't have CG, where you can just make things blow up and Wonder Woman flying around in the air for like 4 hours of a six-hour movie that should have been an hour-and-a-half movie. And so you had to do other devices to make the interesting, and it's, you know, I think it's like kids these days, you know, if you don't have a, you know, your phone in front of you playing games, you can't understand. We're back, you know, when we were growing up, we were falling off playgrounds and, you know, spearing ourselves with metal on concrete, right? So it was a different world back then, right?
Yeah.
So you got to appreciate it from that standpoint. But I can see how our younger listeners may not enjoy that movie as much as Rounders.
Well, the characters in it, too. You know, I mean, that's what makes Rounders so good. The characters, these
right.
people, you know, the guy trying to do the stats and the pad, you know, and then the lady who's a dealer and the way they would just rip up the decks and stuff. I mean, it was just, there was just so much to it that I appreciate now looking back on it rather than in the moment. And it's just, it was a good movie. It really, it does not deserve to be three either.
No.
Yeah.
So number two, Molly's Game.
Yeah.
All right. So a poker movie. I will give it that.
Yeah, it's a poker movie.
I am not going to criticize anything Jessica Chastain does. She could read the yellow pages to me, and I'm giving that 10 out of 10.
Yes,
so.
She's phenomenal.
You know, it was based on her book. So from what I could tell, it was true to her story. Which is kind of a big deal for me. I hate when they, like, Ben Affleck totally messes up Argo with a bunch of comical, untrue things in it, right? So so there is that. Now, obviously, it's her story, and there's other folks out there saying her story is not the right one. But anyhow, so it was worth the $12. That's kind of what I can say, right?
Right.
I did not like it. It held my interest. I did not roll my eyes at all. I did not walk out going, whatever. But number two on any list? Not even number two in the Jessica Chastain filmography.
on this list, I would put it probably fifth or sixth or something. I mean, maybe fourth, depending on... I haven't seen Mississippi Grind, so... But, yeah, not number two. That's definitely for sure.
Yeah. But yeah, it is a poker movie, so I'll give that. And Michael Cera was fantastic as Tobey Maguire. I mean, I know they don't call him
that. Maguire. Player X or whatever.
We know better, right?
We know better.
So, no, it's enjoyable. And if you haven't watched it, I'm not telling you not to watch it. Go ahead and watch it. But, yeah, it's not a number two.
No, not close.
All right, so drum roll. Number one, Casino Royale.
Wait, you mean it's not Shade with Sylvester Stallone?
Oh, my God. I cannot believe that was overlooked. Sorry, Lucky, you're off the list.
That would be 3B, I think, right? Because that's basically a Cincinnati Kid told in a really horrible way. Casino Royale, one poker scene in the movie, and now it's a poker movie.
Yeah, right.
Unreal. It's ridiculous.
Completely ridiculous poker scene, too, by the way. So
by that caveat, that means that we should now look at other shows like the episode where Friends has poker in it now makes it a poker show.
Yeah.
Right? Friends is a poker show because they played poker once.
A good episode, though, so.
Yeah, it was a great episode.
But yeah, you're right. Friends is not a poker show.
Right. So. And Casino Royale is not a poker movie.
And this is really the weakness of this scale, because people ranking Casino Royale are people who are Bond fans, people who are action fans, people who like that genre, Daniel Craig fans. I mean, again, I have not seen this movie, but everybody has seen it, has told me it's fantastic, so I believe that's why it's a highly ranked movie, but it's only a poker movie to the uninitiated.
Yeah, it was a good movie. But it's not a poker movie. And so, where's the Grand? I want that to be number one.
I was just going to say, I mean, it's really... the Grand's got to be on every poker list. Now, I mean, you can love it or hate it. I actually thought the Grand was really good. I don't think... I mean, enjoyable, I should say.
Yeah.
There's a difference between enjoyable and a well-made movie.
Right.
But it was very, very enjoyable. And if you were looking for something poker to watch, I would definitely suggest the Grand over half of these movies, right?
So yeah. For fun.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I would say that if we were like Cincinnati Kid and Rounders is 1A and 1B or whatever you want to do with those, you take those two out. I mean, there's nothing left here. I mean, really, this list is just, and it's sad because, you know, the problem is that we said earlier in the segment is that there just aren't any good poker movies.
Yeah.
There just aren't.
I think that's why Rounders really, really became that movie, right?
Cause yeah.
They found a niche that just wasn't being done properly, right?
Yep.
And no one since then has been able to come up with it, except for Runner by the same folks, and that is, let me check, number 960 on this list.
Yeah, because it had one poker scene at the beginning of the movie where he gets all his money taken online, and then that's it. That's the rest of the poker. There's no poker. I was wishing you snuck in some beer for me in that movie theater that night, and I don't even drink. That's how bad that was. We were guests to see that screening of that movie.
That's right. Well, I mean, that was the best thing about Runners, we didn't pay to see it.
Yeah, we didn't pay to see it. Oh, we paid. We paid with our lives.
No, that's true. Yes, we paid with 2 hours.
That was horrible. I remember making a big deal about it, too. I'm like, wow, Scott and I got invited to this private screening. I feel so important. And we get there, and I'm like, oh, pass the Pabst. And I don't even drink. All right, well, that was a good segment.
Oh, man. All right. Here's this week's update on casino and poker room reopenings. Ottawa Casino Petoskey.
Yeah.
Michigan has reopened its poker room. Silverado Franklin in South Dakota has reopened its poker room. Lucky Chances in California has reopened its outdoor gaming facility. And most other California card clubs are getting permission to reopen their outdoor gaming facilities soon, too. So check your local listings. And not accounting for the recent temporary closings, we now have 215 reopened poker rooms in the United States. AntiUpMagazine.com/reopen lists verified details on casino poker room reopenings. If you have any updates, email us at editor@AntiUpMagazine.com. We are also emailing a weekly e-blast with updates that you can subscribe to on the homepage of AntiUpMagazine.com, and I realized I just didn't update that ticker, so it's actually 216, if that makes a difference.
Wow.
You know, in case anybody's doing some, you know, betting squares or anything like that, I want to be sure that the money's going to the right person. So.
Well, we rambled on for a while, so I'm just going to skip to O'Malley's move.
Quite O'Fine. That's fine.
We get to complete it today, which is always exciting. So here comes part one. Refresh our memories. We'll see you on the other side.
Hello, and welcome to another O'Malley's Move. I'm Malcolm O'Malley. This week we are playing $5 $10 in a home game we are starting to regular. The players in this game are usually really good, and we've been a losing player here so far, but we seem to be turning a corner into a break-even one. The game is six-handed. The blinds post, the under-the-gun folds, and we're in the MP with 1250 down 250. We have the jack of clubs, 10 of clubs. The table standard raise is 3x, so we make it $30 to go. The hijack and button both call, and the blinds both fold. The button is a good player who knows the game well and can be pretty sneaky. He's up 200 as he started the hand with 1700. The pot is 105, and the flop is the ace of hearts, 10 of spades, 9 of diamonds. We are first to act with middle pair and some backdoor equity. We make it $60 to go. The hijack folds, but the button calls. There's now 225 in the pot, and the turn is the 8 of clubs. We now have an open ender to go along with our second pair. We make it 125 to go. The button raises us to 275. I'm beginning to think we are behind, but decide to call. There's now 775 in the pot, and the river is the jack of spades. I didn't really know what else to do, so I checked. The button down bets to 250. So, we're getting a good price with two pair. What's the move?
All right, the down bet is definitely interesting. It definitely screams value bet to me. But would you feel confident making this value bet with a naked ace, like ace-queen? Probably. I'm probably talking myself into a call that I shouldn't make, but I'm intrigued enough to do so with the size of the bet.
I'd probably call, but I wouldn't be surprised if we were up against like aces up. So I don't know, but I probably would call in this moment. I feel like it's worthy of a call. So here comes part two.
Hello again. I think my biggest mistake in this hand was on the turn. I think that's either a folding situation or a raising situation. We most likely aren't getting paid off if we hit our straight, and we're most likely behind once we get raised. This is probably a fold on the river, as this screams value bet, but the price is just too good. Although, I'm not sure what ace makes sense that we are beating that he wouldn't have raised with preflop. Honestly, looking back, I can't think of any hand we're beating here. We make a hasty call. Our opponent announces two pair and tables the Cosenza, suited in diamonds. Nice hand. Until next time, I'm Malcolm O'Malley saying you've got to extend yourself to get better at this game. Just make sure you're comfortable with the stakes. I hope to see you on the felt.
Well, I said I was probably talking myself into a call I shouldn't make, and darn it if I wasn't right, Chris.
Done in by the Cosenza. Was that Faso impersonating O'Malley? Faso makes it on the show twice today.
Oh, man, yes, really. We need to do a Where Is He Now segment next
time. I was going to say, where in the world is Carmen Sandiego? Where is he? I haven't seen him in, man, can't remember the last time I saw Faso.
Yeah, I felt like that. We just haven't had a home game in years, so.
Yeah, that's too bad.
We'll get that back as soon as the world, figures out this COVID stuff, you know. Get the vaccine, folks. If you don't want the vaccine, give me it. I'll take
give
it.
Me your vaccine. I'll take it right now. Twice.
All right, it's time for the AdvancedPokerTraining.com Hand of the Week. Send your hands or situations to podcast@antiupmagazine.com. If you have won something from us in the past year, you'll get a free membership to Advanced Poker Training, the world's number one poker training site. And remember, we're still hanging out with Paul Gerritsen. He sent us in five hands, I think, right?
Yeah, I think it's five.
And he said all of them were good except for the last one. So, but we're going to use the last one, too. So.
Okay.
If you taken a week or two off, Paul plays in Bay Area card rooms in California, where they do a 1-1-2 no limit, and that the other dollar is on the button post, and you have to complete to $4 if you want to stay in the game, or obviously you can raise as well too. So that's the scenario, and it's been a little bit interesting on both hands, I think. So
yeah,
let's see how it affects this game, this hand.
Has he won a hand yet? I can't remember if he's won any of these. I don't think.
Wow, I can't remember.
I don't think he's won any hands, but.
Let's see. No, let's see. Last one, he lost to a river straight with that awful six tray offsuit.
Yep.
No, he won the first hand with his ace king. So.
All right, good. Because I didn't want this to be one of these, bad beat, diatribes. You owe me a dollar for each one of these hands. I want $5 pronto.
So, yes, if you're betting at home, Paul is 1-1 so far. So,
okay.
Hand number three.
All right, good. So.
All right, this time he's been playing at this table for a few hours. He had already lost his first $200 buy-in, but had built my second up to about $350. Since the villain is in middle position, he's a solid player who usually plays good hands. He's shown down the winning hand a few times, but also made a big bluff to win a pot. He has me covered, but barely. The under the gun raises to $15, which has been standard for this table. That middle position villain calls, the cutoff calls, and we are on the button, Chris, with the 9 of diamonds, 7 of diamonds.
Yeah, that's going to find the muck.
Yeah, it's going to be hard for me to make this call here. We're in position. We've got a hand that could stack some folks, so... I mean, like, depending on how the play is going, I mean, I might take a flyer here, but that's a lot of action out there, and you're under the gun. So, I mean, I guess that's what we're getting at, though. I mean, when I say you can stack someone, the other gun, we're going to have to give them credit for, you know, one of those big hands probably. And so if we hit our straight or flush, it's going to be hard to imagine that he has that and he can get away from it. So that would be the justification for calling
here. Yeah, I mean, the plus side to suited one gapper that people probably aren't putting you on for a raise, you know, calling a raise. Two, you have at least three people in the hand already with you. So suited connectors, suited one gappers play best with multiple people in the hand. And you have position, you're on the button. So these are all good things, but you really got to be disciplined and really know your opponents to play this effectively, because basically you're playing them, not your cards, unless you somehow hit them, and then you have, you know, the odds to play this hand for drawing and stuff because you have enough people in the hand. But yeah, I mean, generally I'm just like, you know what, all right, I know I have the button here, but I'm gonna be one off the button next hand, so it's gonna find the muck, because I really don't feel like spending $15 to watch some random flop that doesn't hit me, or if it does, then I'm gonna be like, well, it only hit me with the 9 or the 7, so these guys could have bigger cards than me. So really, what am I? I'm hoping for a remarkable flop for $15. I'd rather do that with a limp than 15. So I'm probably gonna find the muck with it. But if I'm feeling good and I'm up a bunch, see, now he said he was up back up to 350, but he's still down 50.
Yep.
So I'm one of those things. I'm like, you know, I'm grateful to be back where I am. Let me pick better spots than this. I realize being on the button is the best spot positionally, but with that hand, I'd rather just move on for one more deal, you know.
So I think you made a good point here. Here's the thing: is that even though we're on button and we have position, which is always powerful, right? We're not going to be able to represent a lot of hands against an under the gun raiser. So
yeah.
You know, if the under the gun checks the flop and has an ace, a king, queen, something like that, and then we're like, okay, well, we'll pretend we have it. Well, I'm going to suspect that we might get check raised at that point or something like that. So we can't represent those big hands. Whereas the opposite, where if we're under the gun with this 9-7 and raising, we can represent those hands, right?
So yeah.
our flop becomes less important when we're under the gun raiser than it is on the button. So.
Agreed.
So let's keep that in mind. That's
great points.
I'm sure we're going to call.
We are brilliant.
Said no one ever. all right, so our hero does call, and apparently no one else does because we're going straight to the flop. So
it's like $60 in the pot.
Four of us going to the flop, which is the 9 of clubs, tray of diamonds, 6 of diamonds, undergun checks, middle position player bets 30, the cutoff calls, and the action's now on us.
See, this is what we're talking about. Because now, okay, you've spent 15, you've hit the top pair with 0 kicker, you have backdoor diamonds, and
now you get actually 4 diamonds, so.
Oh, yeah. So now you had a diamond flush draw.
Yep.
So now, but it's not the nut flush draw. So it's okay. It's a good flop for us. Top pair and 4 diamonds is not a bad flop. It's just this is how you get into trouble, too, because now you're thinking, okay, do I just call? Or do I raise on the come with top pair? And if I raise and then someone else has a bigger pair than us, they might put us all in. They put us all in. Now we have to hit our flush because they have aces or kings or tens or queens, whatever. And then it's like now you're putting your whole stack in for a 9-high flush, hopefully. So, yeah, this is a good flop for us. It's not bad. For some reason, I was thinking that I can't read my own writing here. So the 6 wasn't a diamond. Okay, so... I think I like a call, though, believe it or not. I don't see any reason to raise. We want the pot odds. We don't want to force people out now. We have top pair. The under the gun check. This way, at least, if you raise and the under gun has a bigger hand, he's going to put you all in, and I don't know if I want to shove with this. So I like a call. Maybe the under the gun folds. Maybe the under the gun, you know, had eights or something and didn't like the fold. Who knows? But if he shoves on us, now we can be like, all right, I can get away from this, or if I get 2 other callers, then it might be worth the call. So I like a call here. I don't think I want to raise.
Well, this is an interesting spot now, and a lot of this comes down to how well you know the players in the hand. So I'll make two of what I think compelling arguments for different plays here. So the call would be because we are on the come here. We've got a hand that hit We got some possibilities to improve, though, you know, you never feel confident with a 9-high flush, but you have some of that stuff. The same thing you mentioned is, you know, we don't want to play for stacks right now with this flop, right? So if we're worried that the middle position player or even the other gun who checked is going to raise us again and get us all in, that would be something I would not be comfortable with here. Now, the argument I can make for raising is, let's say the under the gun, as we mentioned, pre-flop is sitting on like kings, queens, or something like that, and for whatever reason decided to check this flop, which doesn't make any sense. Now that somebody's bet and then we've raised, we've frozen that hand out, right? I don't think that hand can call anymore because they have to assume that they're behind one hand at least, if not two. So we get them out of the way. Two, and then also, you know, the old school get a free card play here, right? So if we can raise here, we miss our flop, or miss our turn, I mean, then we could check behind and have more opportunities to make this hand a little stronger than it is. So it really comes down to whether I feel like someone's going to raise my re-raise. If that's going to happen, I would rather call. But if I feel like my raise is going to be respected and just called, or if he wants to get out of the pot, either way, then I'll raise. So that's really what I'd come down.
Yeah, I think generally we have come up against any under-the-gun pre-flop raiser who gets a perfect flop like this and then checks, almost always flops a set or has an overpair and hopes someone's going to try to steal it from him. You know what I mean? Because why would you let that flop go without betting, especially with two diamonds, two to a straight in two different directions, really? You know, not that people are calling raises with 4-5, but they might be, or 7-8. So
last week they called it with 6-trace.
Yeah, so exactly. So to me, for an under-the-gun raiser to now not bet and c-bet after he took control of this with a pre-flop raise means either he really whiffed it and is just a wuss, or he could have a bigger hand. So now if I raise, no matter what I make it, I could be playing for stacks here now. Because if I'm a min raise, this isn't going to get anyone out who's already called.
Yeah. So, yeah, you're talking maybe, what, a raise to 100 probably?
Yeah, if you make it like 100 or whatever, then they're going to make – now if the under the gun says, ha-ha, I've got my aces, ha-ha, I got my set, you know, now he makes it 300. Well, we only had 350 in front of us, so now we're looking at being down 400 total for the night on a 9-high flush draw with a pair of nines. So do I want to put my stack in on that hand, on the strength of that hand? I don't know. But I'm happy to call and see what the under the gun does. If the under the gun folds now, then that's great. I've reduced the field a little bit. My nines might hold up. Somebody could be betting to steal. Somebody could bet in the draw. And I might have a pair of nines that win now. So I don't mind the call. But a raise could now make me forced to play my whole stack on a draw with a pair, which is fine. I mean, you've heard that a lot of times. People say a pair and a flush draw, people get it in all the time.
Yeah.
But this table, the way I've been running, yeah, okay, I'm starting to build my stack back, but I'm still down. So I don't know. It's I could go either way on it, but I think I'd rather call here.
All right. Our hero says, I hit this board pretty hard, but I'm vulnerable. I want to eliminate a couple opponents, so I raised to $120.
Wow.
Under the gun folds, but the middle position player goes all in for 240, covering my 220. The cutoff folds and it's back to us.
Well, I mean, now you can't fold. First of all, that was a 4x raise, which is massive. I would have gone 90, you know, or 100. But now, like we said, you have, you know, how could you fold with that much out there now with the top pair and a flush draw, which is almost what you wanted in the first place. So if you wanted that, then you might as well just shove pre-flop. I mean, post-flop. But, yeah, I don't think you can fold now. I mean, the only way you could fold is if you knew they had a bigger flush draw, and even then you still could win with your nines, so then it's really only... So I don't know. Even then...
Yeah, I think that's the interesting thing here, right? So it's either this guy is on a bigger flush draw, which would lead me to believe that our nines are good, and if we can fade the diamonds, we'll win, right?
Yeah.
Or... he's on a set or two pair doesn't really make sense here, but a set or something else that has his beat right now, but doesn't have diamonds, and then we need to hit a diamond to win, right? So one or the other. So that's why I think you do need to make this call. I just would have felt more comfortable making this call with another card out there to see, right?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It is tough to fold here with where we are, because either way, I have to assume we have outs either way, depending on what this guy has, so...
Yeah, I mean, if we just call the 30, we get to see the turn for $30, you know. And then by then, if it gets in the middle position, player's going to be acting first, he's not going to shove. He's going to bet like 60 or something, and then you're like, okay, I can call 60 here, because now it's only costing me 90 rather than my whole stack to see the river for the flush. It's just, that raise was so big, and now you're going to have to put your whole stack in there. Now, I'm not saying it's not going to work out. I have no idea, but really, that's tough. That's tough. I would have made it. Even so, I think if you make it 90, this guy's probably still shoving. That doesn't mean you shouldn't still make the better move, and the better move is probably just calling or making it 90.
All right. Our hero says, I figure he's either on a draw and I'm ahead with my pair of nines, or I'm behind but can catch up with my flush draw. With the flop and my decision to raise, I had also mentally committed myself to going all the way with his hand, regardless of what the villain did. Was that a bad mindset, he asked. I don't think it was a bad mindset, as long as you don't change that train of thought now, right? So if you made that raise knowing full well that you were probably going to have to play for stacks here, then this is what you got, and you got a call, right?
So yeah, you're pretty consistent with that on our show over the last 15 years or whatever it is we've been doing this. You say that often, and it's true. I mean, if you have a plan, and that's your plan, it's one thing to alter your plan based on new information, but if you knew that what you did on that flop was going to could result in you going all the way with it and you were comfortable with that, then there's no reason not to call here.
Right. All right, our hero calls. The turn is the Jack of Hearts. The river is the Five of Diamonds.
Okay, so we got our flush, but are we happy about it?
Opponent confidently turns over 4-7 offsuit. River straight.
What?
And I turn over my flush to take the $740 pot.
What?
Hero says, was I too aggressive on the flop with a raise and then an all-in call? He easily could have had a higher flush draw. Or set. In fact, when we pushed all in, the whole table started talking set over set. Wow. All right. So last week, we lost to a river straight with 6 tray offsuit. This week, we win when he hits a straight, but we hit our flush with a 4-7. Wow.
How is 4-7? Right? How is 4-7 in this hand? One. Two. Right?
Offsuit.
And then offsuit. And then, okay, so he flops a gutter and then bets out, which is fine. He's trying to, because the under the gun checked to him.
Yeah,
so he's trying to steal it, right? Yep. Right? Doesn't get what he wants because we raised to 120. Does he really think we're going to fold? So he's putting stack in, right, for a gutter? Because he's not bluffing us anymore. We're not going anywhere. We made it 120. We proved that we're not going anywhere. So he wanted to get called with a gutter. That's insane.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, it's different with our raise versus his all-in raise, right? So, you know, his all-in at that point, we are committed at 120. We are committed. It's almost impossible to come up with a scenario where it's proper to fold there, right?
Yeah.
It's a different story when we raise, right? I mean, we could – oh, man, it just doesn't make a lot of sense. But then again, playing – I got to say, I'm trying to go through every hand I've played in poker real quickly here. I don't think I've ever called a raise with 4-7 offsuit, ever. Even in the old Florida $2 game.
Yep. And even if you did, because you're just like, oh, I can outplay this table, blah, blah, blah. The big mistake is after we raise his, I'm going to try to steal this and, you know, semi-bluff theory of poker crap. But when that turn, you know what I mean? When it gets to you, I mean, for your turn to bet, and you make it 120, this guy's got to now shut it down. Instead, he doubles down and shoves. And it's like, you really think we're going to fold? You're not bluffing anybody for another $200 when there's 400 out there.
Well, and I'll say the other mistake he made before that was even betting this flop. You know, I get the idea that you want to take control of this hand, but there are too many people in this hand to win this hand with a $30 bet.
Yep.
At 7 high, right? So, yeah, so the end of the gun slowed down, although we made a pretty compelling point, I think, when we talk about that, that doesn't mean that the end of the gun didn't have a good hand, right? But so anyhow, so you got him to worry about. And then you've got two players behind you who have position. So what makes you think that that $30 bet with this flop is going to get anybody out?
Yeah, that's the thing is –
$15 raise to begin with. So, I mean, you're just missing – you're trying to be aggressive, but you're being aggressive at the very wrong time here.
Yeah, it's like with apologies to Todd Brunson, you know, this is another platinum rule. And it's, you can bluff one person, but it's a lot harder to bluff more than one. And especially when you have three people left in the hand still.
Yeah.
You know, under the gun, still, you don't know what he's got. He could be aces and he's check raising everyone. You know, he could have the set of nines. He's not going anywhere. And the fact that he hit the five is hilarious. This back-to-back weeks with horrible, horrible hands, river of straight with a gutter.
You don't think he was just like giddy when he saw that. He probably didn't even notice it was a diamond, right? He's just like, oh my God, this actually works. Give me this pot. And then like, oh.
Sorry. Oh, man. Unreal.
Wow. Yeah, so.
It's a big pot.
Yeah, Paul, keep playing these games, man, because I know you lose them with some crazy cards, but you're going to win more pots than you're going to lose with players playing like this. So.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that put them positive for the day, too, so that's always good.
Yeah.
Can't wait for next week. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
We'll see you at the tables.
Ante Up is a production of AnteUpMagazine.com. Contact the show at podcast@AnteUpMagazine.com. If you'd like to advertise, send an email to advertising@anteupmagazine.com or call 727-331-4335. Some music used in this episode comes courtesy of the PodSafe Music Network.